Welcome to Scenes, conversations in culture with the people who know it best. We chat with guests across music, art, fashion, film, sport and technology in a bid to understand the scenes we love that little bit better. I'm your host Lenny, and in this episode I am joined by Lenny and Sophie from Sister Midnight, who share what life has been like since they decided to create a community benefit society, the impact of grassroots venues, Southeast London's unique music scene, and the importance of funding in culture. I truly hope this episode inspires you to support the musicians, artists, and performers in your local area. After all, culture is community, and our communities are like family. Multi-hyphenate creative entity Sister Midnight is a community benefit society in Lewisham run by Lenny, Sophie and Lottie. Formerly a grassroots venue based in Deptford, Sister Midnight quickly became an important part of the local music scene. Since the pandemic sadly forced its closure, the trio have had their sights set on community-based venue ownership. Their mission is to create an accessible, affordable and inclusive grassroots music venue and community pub, where people can come together and enjoy the best of South East London's diverse and cutting-edge music culture. London, famous for its deep roots in music of all genres, has been losing venues at an alarming rate. According to the Music Venue Trust, more than 35% of grassroots music venues have closed in the past 20 years. Live music, such an essential and joyous part of people's lives, has fallen victim to an onslaught of increasing logistical problems. Cuts to art funding, gentrification, rising rental prices and more. Venue ownership can underpin this. Landlords, often with little care or regards for the purpose their properties serve, hold no strong attachment for owning music venues. Fan-owned venues challenge this. Today in the studio, we are so pleased to present Lenny and Sophie, two-thirds of Sister Midnight, who are taking on this challenge for their community in Lewisham. How are you both?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. And breathe. I didn't realise how long it would take me to say all of that.
Good. That was quite an intro. Very comprehensive, though.
And it was all correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Great, because that's the thing you worry about the most. You kind of deliver it and you're kind of like, is it right?
No, but, smashed it.
And also, I almost forgot, we've also got Ruby in the room as well.
Hi. Still micless, but...
I know. We did promise last time that we'd mic her up. But she's just going to have to share my mic. So if you've got anything interesting to say, Ruby, pipe up, jump in.
Cool.
So we'll kick things off as we always do. One at a time, can you tell us the first thing you fell in love with and the impact it has had on you later in life?
Oh, that's a big question. For me, it was when my parents bought me my first piano. I think I was about 3 or 4. And I remember sitting on the stairs to my house in the hallway, watching the piano removal guys like wheel it in and just like being completely over the moon and then not knowing how to play it at all. But I used to make up little songs, which I called fairy songs, which were just like playing the very top keys of the piano. But I think that was really my first proper interaction with music and kind of the thing that has catalyzed like my whole love of music throughout my whole life. So yeah, I think that was probably my first love.
Amazing. And are you still a keen pianist now?
I wish I was. I love to play when I can, but I live on a top floor flat in London. It's really expensive.
Say no more.
Yeah, really expensive to get a piano up there, but like one day it's my goal to get another one at some point.
It's funny you said instrument, because I was going to say the first thing I thought of was like dancing, because I was like a dancer from the age of like 4 years old. But I think that's kind of what also got me into music through like, yeah, the ages of 4 to, I think I was dancing competitively till I was like 16 or something. But like I did it like every day, like 5 times a week. So it's like my whole life and I loved it. But I think now that's kind of what I enjoy most about music, I think, is dance. But I don't dance as much anymore unless I'm in the club. but it's paid off.
Yeah, no, you are a great dancer, to be fair. I've seen you in action. It's beautiful stuff. Mesmerizing.
Love that. So, can you give us a brief history of Sister Midnight?
Yeah, we can. A brief history is difficult, but I'll try and keep this one concise. Before it was Sister Midnight, it was a record shop and a music venue, this little building on a back street in Deptford. And while I was a student, I'd like literally just got my first student house in Deptford, and was having a little explore, stumbled upon the space and just thought, this is amazing, I want to be involved in this any way I can. So I asked them if I could volunteer, and they were like, yeah, sure. So I did for 3 years, sort of volunteered and worked for them on and off. And when my degree was coming to an end, they told me that they were planning to close it down, and someone had made an offer to take over the space from them and turn it into a cheese and wine bar. And I thought, fuck that. So I scraped together sort of all the money I had, my savings, even used a bit of my student loan, but we won't tell the student loans company that, and bought the rights to the lease from them and took on the space, and that's how Sister Midnight was born. And we just desperately wanted to keep it as a space that was there for the local community, for local music, because it was such an important part of that scene in Deptford. And so we kept just that kind of thing going there, kept it as a record shop and a venue. And we were there for 2.5 years and it was absolutely beautiful. But when the pandemic hit, there was all sorts of problems with the site. Social distancing would have been a nightmare. We couldn't reopen at all, even when you were allowed to have people in like 2 meters apart. It would have meant that we needed 3 or 4 members of staff to police that, and our capacity would have been 2. So,
four staff to 2 customers.
Wow. Yeah, so it wouldn't have worked. So we didn't reopen, and we also had issues like flooding because the landlord didn't have the money to maintain the building and stuff. So we sadly had to wave goodbye to that space, which broke my heart a little bit. But it was a really important time for reconsidering how we could bring Sister Midnight back and keep it as a space that was for the community and for the music scene there, but make it more resilient in the long term and make it something that wasn't just going to disappear in 2 years again because our landlord didn't want to fix a leak, or, you know, because there was a pandemic and we didn't have the infrastructure or like just the funds to survive it. So that was really how we landed on the idea of a community owned structure. So I did a big community consultation and kind of said to everyone, there's this pub down the road that's been sat empty for God knows how many years. Why don't we just try and raise the money as a community, buy it, and it can be Sister Midnight's new home. And we had an overwhelming response to that consultation. And it was at that point that Sophie came on board. And the rest is history, really.
For the uneducated in the room, aka myself, what is a community benefit society?
A community benefit society runs a bit like a cooperative. We're a not-for-profit and we work in terms of like shares. So last year we did like a big share offer and our community can invest in the business. They become part owner of the business. It's run very democratically. It's a beautiful, amazing structure. I think that not a lot of people know about, but especially if we're trying to take over an asset, it's as a community group, like it's a really amazing kind of route to go down, I think.
Yeah, the community shares are such an important tool because when you get that investment from the community, it just gives you the kind of finance that you need to grow as a social enterprise that you might not typically get from private lenders. And then when people do buy those shares, like Sophie says, they become a part owner of the business and a member of the society, and it gives them a voting right. So that democracy element is what we love about it. And also the fact that voting power can't be bought because it's 1 vote per member. So if you invest £100 or £10,000, your voting rights, your democratic control within the business is the same. So it gives everyone an equal voice.
And how did you go about building that community from the ground up? Because you mentioned it and made it sound so easy from the point of like, we need to raise this money to people investing. I think most people would see that bridge in front of them and think, there's no way I can cross that? How did you get from A to B?
You know what? I think it was in a really weird time where it just came out of like another lockdown. And I think when we first like proposed these plans we had and this idea that you'd come up with, I think people were really excited. And like we grasped like this opportunity in time where, I don't know, it spread really quickly. Like the news spread and...
It went kind of viral, didn't it?
Yeah, which I don't think...
South East London viral.
Yeah, South East London viral. Yeah, come on. That's my postcode.
I was going to bring it up later, but yeah, I'm an ocean boy.
Come on. Yeah. Whereas I think maybe if we'd done it now, it might not have got the same outreach. I don't know.
No, I agree with that. I think it was also a moment in time where people didn't have access to venues and community spaces like that in the same way. Mm. People were really understanding at that point of the community value that these kind of places hold, and were really keen to see new spaces come into existence and for existing spaces to stay there. And obviously a lot of people in lockdown who were able to keep their jobs suddenly found themselves with a lot more disposable income because they weren't going out to the pub every night. Mm-hmm. And so there was kind of that opportunity there to say, well, hey, if you're not going to spend £6 on a pint a few times a week, why don't you put that into our society as an investment and help us achieve something that's going to be really great for the community in the long term? But I have to say, it wasn't easy building that community. Like, we had this sort of really fortunate instance of the first consultation going a bit viral, but once we got to the point of actually campaigning, it was a lot of work. We were out on the streets every single day, canvassing, knocking on doors, going to markets, handing out flyers. It was really, really hard work. We loved almost every second of it, but
the door knocking
was nerve-wracking. Yeah.
Oh, brutal. Must be brutal.
Most people were amazing, like really, really, really lovely and excited by it. Like, I hardly came across anyone who like slammed the door in my face. I think mostly because I was thinking, like, normally you don't really get people knocking on your door anymore. Mm. Do you? So I think people were first of all interested, and then when we told them what it was about, they go to close, but then they'd be like, oh, sorry, what are you doing? So it was nice, it was interesting.
Yeah, I think that was one of the best parts about the campaign, really. Like, although it was kind of nerve-wracking to be out there just talking to people that you didn't know about this grand idea that we had, it was actually so nice just meeting people from the community. And I feel like we feel a lot more rooted in the local community there, like even more so than we were before, because we've just met so many new amazing people who are willing to give their time and their money to what we're doing, which is just beautiful.
Yeah, that's incredible. It probably makes a difference as well, the fact that you're canvassing for something that you're doing. I think most people, when it comes to door-to-door sales or even like street sales, are used to someone being paid by a company to sell their product, whereas you're there, heart on your sleeve, saying, this is something that we're doing, and we're doing it for you.
Yeah, I mean, that was beautiful, but also I think it made us vulnerable at times to people questioning our ability to do it. We're women, we're under 30, and if someone arrives on your doorstep who looks like us and says, hey, we're going to try and raise a few million pounds to buy a pub and make it into a community venue, they're just like, what? Sorry, you guys are leading this project, really? Like, okay, no thank you. So we did experience a bit of that, and I think that's
a couple of times.
It's been a common theme about across this project, that sometimes we have struggled with people disbelieving in our ability to do this, but once we'd raised £250,000, that happened less.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, well, those ones that weren't in it missed their opportunity, I suppose.
Yeah, a little bit.
In an interview, you said that without community-owned venues, we wouldn't have acts such as the Beatles or Oasis. Why are they such important spaces for musicians and entertainers?
So grassroots venues really act as the research and development department for the entire music industry. They are the seedbed of talent that underpins everything else that goes on across the entire sector. If you don't have those spaces that will take a chance on artists when they're just starting out, they haven't perhaps like honed their craft as much as they need to, they're less commercially viable. You don't get those people then going on to get record deals and getting great managers and agents in place who can push them up to the point of doing stadium tours or, you know, being as big as like the Beatles or Oasis or Stormzy or Ed Sheeran. Like, all of these massive artists start out, generally speaking, in small venues. So without them, the whole industry would just collapse.
And you mentioned earlier that when you first got into the record shop in Deptford that you volunteered. How much do these places rely on people like yourself volunteering, given their free time? And secondary to that, you mentioned how these record labels make, you know, they make so much money from these artists that do these stadium tours and get, become so successful. Why isn't there more of like a trickle-down effect to the venues that give them the start?
That's a great question. There should be more, more like supporting income from bigger entities and bigger players in the industry. They should be giving handouts to grassroots organisations, grassroots records and grassroots record labels and grassroots venues. All of these smaller organisations that form like the bottom of that pyramid within the industry should be getting money from the people at the top who are making millions of pounds a year. I don't know why that isn't a thing, but if we could get, I don't know, PRS and Sony and Warner in the room, maybe we could ask them. But they tend not to have conversations with people like us that easily. But, you know, it's an interesting point, and perhaps if grassroots venues were subsidised better, then they wouldn't have to rely on volunteer support so much. I think it is a big part of the grassroots music scene at the moment is volunteer support and people giving their time and their skills for free, but it shouldn't be that way. Everyone should be fairly compensated for their contributions to culture. And there has been like a slight shift in that. Before the pandemic, I think about 17% of grassroots music venues in the country had ever received public grant funding. And post-pandemic, that figure is about 72%. So there's been a massive change in the way that even public funding bodies value the contributions that grassroots venues have to culture. But there needs to be more of that. There needs to be more of a shift. And I think that's why community ownership models and not-for-profit models are kind of on the rise amongst cultural organisations, because it gives them, and oftentimes, like the tools to raise money that they need through things like community share offers and crowdfunders, because people are more willing to give to not-for-profit organisations under those circumstances, but also increases their chances of getting grant funding, because a lot of grant funders prefer not-for-profit structures. So I think we're kind of starting to see culture be financially supported in a different way now, and I think that's really important, because it's just not sustainable for people to be giving their time for free.
Yeah. And again, do you think that links partly back to the pandemic and people realising the value that they place on culture?
100% agree with that. I think the pandemic really showed people what they loved and what they missed and what needed to be protected.
I think also for a lot of hospitality workers, most of them had time off during the pandemic, and it gave them a chance to see what life is like when you're not constantly burnt out and working yourself to your physical and mental limit, which is very common in the hospitality industry. And so I think it's given people this kind of taste of what life could be like if working conditions were fairer. And I think people are demanding better conditions now, which is why we've seen lots of workers leave the hospitality industry, and it's very hard to get workers into roles now that are at minimum wage, because people just understand that their labour has more value than that.
When you first started the campaign, it was to get the venue, and although that hasn't happened straight away, I then read that you're now looking for a meanwhile venue. So what's that transition been like? What's the reception been like from people that invested, and what is the plan for the meanwhile venue?
Yeah, we started out trying to buy this pub that was on the market for £3 million, and it all looked like that was gonna possibly quite realistically be feasible. But as we had got to the point of raising quite a significant chunk of money, and we were able to get further down the line with having conversations with banks, we got to the point of doing a number of valuation reports on the building and discovered that its actual market value was somewhere between 1.6 and 1.8 million. So quite a significant gap between the actual value of the building and what the owners were asking for it.
And at that point, we kind of assumed that oftentimes when people are selling big buildings, they'll just whack a price on it and hope for the best, hope that someone with more money than sense comes along. But if they get an offer at fair market value, then they'll say yes. And we thought that would happen, but it didn't. The owners genuinely would not sell for a penny less than £3 million. And even if we had £3 million sat in our bank account, I think there is a massive ethical question around the way that we're spending public funding and shareholders' money. And we didn't feel that it was at all in line with our organisational ethics to be putting money that people had given us in good faith towards over £1 million of private profit for one person. So we had to abandon that pub, and that was absolutely heartbreaking because we put, I think at that point, over a year's work into putting this campaign together and raising money towards it. And this news also came at a time when the cost of living crisis was starting to set in, interest rates were starting to rise quite sharply, and we realised that taking on really significant debt funding was not going to bear the same level of risk that we thought it might when we started out with these plans. So we had to think about repositioning that goal of owning our building to being a more long-term one. And we went back to the investors and said, you know, I think we're going to have to consider taking on a meanwhile space, thinking of somewhere that we can set up for the medium term, deliver all the things that we've said to you that we're going to deliver in terms of a great music venue, a space for the community, a space for community organising and mutual aid. But it's just not going to be a building that we own, and that's okay because this time will give us an opportunity to strengthen our financial position and to raise more money and put profits in reserve, and eventually we can hopefully revisit this idea of owning our permanent space. And we were really lucky that 97% of the investors that completed that survey said that they would back that.
So good.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's a lot of like really genuine faith as well, which is really beautiful. Like,
yeah. And it was just, I think we were so, we were really like struggling with sort of just the burnout and the endless setbacks at that point. And it was just really like genuinely like uplifting, like so reassuring just to read some of those comments, wasn't it, from the community?
Some of the responses, and that we did like a Google form that people could like fill out and tell us their thoughts or like what they envision and stuff. But it was so supportive, and it was just like, keep going, like we're behind you all the way. And it's even like now, like I was like yesterday we were at a conference and I was just got chatting to someone, and then it turns out they were an investor. So like people would just pop up like everywhere, and like, even she was just like, yeah, cool, I'm excited to see what's happening.
With these sorts of ventures, it's easy to ask where those struggles have been. So instead of that, I prefer to focus on the positives. So what have been the best parts of the journey for you both?
I don't know, I feel like we're just like living a dream every day. It's amazing. Like just working like with your best friends, and just, it's like, you know, like at school when you worked on like a project.
Yes.
Feels like
if you got the good group.
Yeah, you get a good group. It feels like that. It feels really like does. Every day we're just like creating something, which is just like, feel really grateful to be able to like wake up and do that.
Yeah,
day, I think
it's beautiful. Like things just fell into place so well with the group of people that we have around us, and like, me and Soph, like, we knew each other from Sister Midnight. Soph had put on nights there before, but we weren't, like, we weren't really mates.
No.
But she messaged me and was like, I love this idea. I, like, I'm in. And it just felt so right from the beginning. And it's just been so beautiful since then. That's genuinely one of the best things to come out of this, is just finding people like Sophie and people like Lottie, where we just, we all have this vision and we're all coming at it from different angles, but there's such a complementary skill set there that we've really been able to craft something between the three of us and between like the wider group of people that have been involved that we really, really believe in. But also the learning for me has just been amazing.
Yeah, same.
none of us knew anything about community businesses or fundraising or really like grant funding before this.
I hardly knew what a cooperative was.
Yeah.
Well, you honestly, you wouldn't know now. The way you both talk about it, it's like you've both got decades of experience. You're not even old enough to have that, but that's what it sounds like.
It feels like it's been decades.
I think what I was most shocked about was the grant funding and like realizing that there's money out there for community groups and like creative projects, but people just don't know how to access it. And like, we were really grateful to have the time to be able to learn that, but yeah. Like that, like if you're working full time and like you don't have the same opportunities, like you, it's just like this thing that's locked off to a lot of people, you know.
It's been like an immense privilege to be able to take the time to learn all these skills and implement them in a way that benefits the community. We actually couldn't have done this if it wasn't for the lockdown. The reason that we were able to undertake this entire project was because Sister Midnight, in its previous iteration as the Record Shop, was awarded cultural recovery funding from Arts Council, and that paid for our wages to think of a way to re-establish the space and make it more sustainable in the long run. So in a really funny way, if the business hadn't closed down, we wouldn't have been able to ever grow it in this way. So it's a sort of strange set of circumstances that have led us to this. But yeah, Soph's totally right. Outside of having your wages paid for 6 months by grant funding, undertaking this kind of community work and this kind of fundraising is a privilege, really. And it's a shame that more people don't get this opportunity, but we're really keen to use this time and this opportunity that we've been granted, that when we do have a space, we can use that as a like a sort of a space for sharing skills and sharing resources and helping other community groups do the same thing that we've done. Because I think that's another thing that has come out of this project that's been so positive, is like a lot of times it really seems like a pipe dream that people could just come together with an idea for a nice space for the community, a thing that they want to do, and take really like tangible, massive steps towards making it happen. We literally fundraised £250,000 out of what feels like thin air, but it wasn't. It was people power, and it was being able to rally our community around this idea and get everyone to pool their money and pool their time and skills and make this happen. And it's amazing to think that like actually when communities pull together in this way, we can achieve really incredible things. And setting that precedent for our community, whether we're successful now or not in finding a space and setting a new venue up, just the fact that we were able to get this money behind us, I feel, is a really strong message to other people that, yes, there's privilege involved with being able to do this, but there are ways that it's achievable when you work as a community. And that's such an important political message, especially in these times when community infrastructure and public services are being cut and defunded and pulled away from people and putting the most vulnerable and marginalised people and community at risk. This is a time when, although yes, the government should be funding the infrastructure that we need, there are actually these mechanisms for us to take that into our own hands. And that's something that we want to see happening a lot more in our community and across other communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a beautiful exchange, you know, between yourselves and the community. And it goes to show that if funding is delivered to the right projects, to the right people, it can have such an amazing impact. And I'm sure that far too often it's not, you know, delivered to the right people or places. Whereas hopefully people, you know, see what you're doing, take a leaf out of your book and try and take some control back for their communities.
Yeah, and I'd like to see funders take a bit of learning away from this as well and be less risk averse and give new groups a chance, because there is a lot of funding out there, but often it's targeted to people who have a track record of already delivering social aims or delivering whatever it is that they're set up to do.
And sometimes you can't even unlock certain funds unless you get to certain stages of projects, and to get to them stages you have to put in a shitload of labour, you know, so like,
and money, and yeah, money, so. You know, a lot of funders want to see ridiculously detailed proposals that take a lot of work with expensive consultants to develop. So it would be great if we could just see more early stage funding available and more big capital funds just to give to groups to be like, hey, here's £1.2 million, go and buy yourself that bit of land and start your community garden or whatever it is you want to do. We just need to have that faith in communities, because these aren't organizations where it's just like one or two people that are going to profit from it. You know, when they are democratically run and genuinely engaging with their communities, like, you can't really get it wrong if you're giving everyone a fair voice and a fair say in how things happen. So there just needs to be that trust between the people with money and the communities that want to benefit from that.
You mentioned earlier that when you started out, you both had no idea really what you were getting into. So how did you cross that line where you went from the point of wanting funding to then convincing whoever the funding body was to give it to you?
Baby steps, wasn't it?
We started off small.
Yeah, I think.
And learned how to write grant applications. and then I think once you've done one, if it's for the same project, it's quite easy to then kind of do the next one.
You learn the spiel, basically. Yeah. You learn what it is that funders are looking for and how to communicate the story of what you're doing to them. And I think also once you've got funding, it's more likely that you'll get funding from other people because they go, hang on, they've been funded by so-and-so, maybe we should give them some money as well. And
it's like a ripple effect.
Exactly, yeah. So I think the first grant that we were awarded was the Boosting Community Business London Fund, which is...
Power to Change.
Yeah, it's Power to Change in conjunction with the GLA and the Cooperatives UK Booster Programme. So basically three different organisations there that have come together, and you can just go to them with an idea and be like, we would like some funding to pay a consultant to help us develop this idea. So that's what we did. I think we got 4 days worth of time with an amazing man called Dave Boyle, who works at the Community Shares Company. I now work with him because he's just amazing and like one of the most incredible people I've met in this whole community scene. So we started working with him, and then he helped us get more funding, and you know, that turned into us getting really, really big funds. It started off as just a few £1,000, and then I think we got awarded a £50,000 equity offer eventually.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, it's it can snowball quickly, but just start out small. And like I'd say to anyone who's looking to get grant funding for a project, speak to all those kind of existing funders like Co-ops UK, like Power to Change, like, you know, your local authority. If you're in London, the GLA are great for this kind of stuff.
National Lottery
Community Fund as well are amazing. But don't be afraid to just apply for the really small ones, even if you think they won't make, if the money isn't going to make a tangible difference to getting you on the way to where you need to be. Just the fact that you've been given funding is a good thing to have in your arsenal, basically.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting the way you applied that funding was to bring someone in who's an expert to then help you get to the next stage. I would never even consider that as like step one.
What we sort of needed to, because we're a community benefit society, we needed a practitioner to set us up as that structure and learn more about that structure in particular. So yeah, it's kind of vital.
Such a niche structure. It was
niche.
Yeah, it really is. There's a growing movement of these kind of businesses, but you can just bring in anyone. You really need someone who understands this and who understands community shares. And Dave has done this time and time again.
It was like having a tutor at one point.
Yeah,
I'd be on Zoom and I'd be like, huh? So
he's setting you homework.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. But he really like held our hand through that process, and like that was another thing that we needed and that I think other groups like us need, is because it's so daunting. You are taking on so much information at the same time doing this incredibly risky thing and really putting yourself out there, and that kind of pastoral support that was provided to us by Dave was like one of the most important things, and I think that's kind of what inspired us to do the same thing for other people in our community. So I'm training now as a community practitioner with Co-ops UK.
Oh, wow.
Being mentored by Dave. So it's come full circle.
So hit Lenny up if you need help.
Basically, yeah.
Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, me and Dave.
So I love Lewisham. It's now what I call home. What makes the music scene there so unique and important?
It's politics. Politics is what makes the music there so special. Lewisham has a really long legacy of grassroots politics and grassroots music that go hand in hand. And as you've seen the political tides sort of ebb and flow, like the music and the counterculture has followed that, or they've followed each other. There's like a there's a duality between those two things, and that's existed historically and continues to exist to the current day, where you have, you know, for example, promoters like Solidarity Tapes, who are regularly putting on live music nights to fundraise for local organisations such as AFRL or MASS, who are organisations that work with asylum seekers and migrants and refugees. And obviously Lewisham Council has just been awarded status as Borough of Refuge because they are taking on so many refugees and rehoming them. And so you kind of see just this trend between music being a form of solidarity with community. And I think that's the most beautiful thing about what's going on in Lewisham. It's all a very like active scene where people are engaged with the issues that are out there and combating them, both in like very practical ways in terms of putting on gigs as fundraisers, but also just the things that they are singing about and like the messages that they're delivering with their music, or the things they're trying to achieve with their music in terms of bringing people together. It's all along that kind of same line of like working for better things for the people around us.
I think also because South London, and like more specifically like South East London, is its kind of own bubble of London that is kind of a little bit cut off, you know, because you don't have a tube and stuff. And like a lot of sometimes people won't come all the way down to South for gigs, but I think it creates this like really supportive network of like organising, but also like music scenes of people who are like from the area, their friends are from the area, and everyone sort of like collectively comes together, goes to the same nights, goes to the same venues, and I think it creates this like really beautiful like hub and like atmosphere, I think.
It really is a community, like in the truest sense of that word.
I mean, I've never lived anywhere else in London, so I can't really, I don't know if I'm saying this complete truth, but I think there's a different atmosphere in South that I don't know if you get in other parts of London.
I don't think you do. You don't really find that community based in North, and I think you're right about it having to do with like, it is kind of like always been a bit of a bubble, and I think that does create this like within that kind of bubble, this like really beautiful kind of community and this experience, like shared experiences.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I mean, look, just it's why it's so important the work that you're doing, right? Is to, you know, have a home for all the things that you just mentioned. So what does the future hold for Sister Midnight?
We've got a lot of things in the works
that
we can't go public about yet, but
we're dying to tell
we're dying to tell people what's going on, and we need and our investors are dying to know what's going on. But we've got exciting things that we've been really working hard on over the past like 9 months, and we can't tell you too much. But
we're still committed to making this happen. Yeah. We're going to bring a community-owned venue to Lewisham one way or another. It might be next year, it might be in 10 years. We're still going to be here. But we're really excited about what is to come. And I think in the meantime, we're just continuing to try and act as a bit of a resource for people who want to do similar things. So yeah, as you said, if anyone's out there and has got an idea for a community project or something that they want to do, hit us up. We'd love to help. We'd love to give you some advice. And hopefully putting on a few more fundraiser gigs as well. They're always good fun.
We usually finish off with the following question, which is, can you recommend something for us to read, listen to or watch that has helped you gain an insight into a culture unfamiliar to our own? But after talking with you both and seeing how passionate you both are about South East London and Lewisham, I'd just love for you to just give some recommendations to people of things that they should go and check out, places they should visit, gigs they should go to, venues they should see in Lewisham.
Oh my God, there's so many. Go to Steam Down on a Wednesday night at Matchstick Pie House. Go to literally anything at the Ivy House over in Nunhead. It's another community-owned pub, and the music they put on there is incredible. go to a Solidarity Tapes night because they are amazing people who bring amazing musicians in to do really great things. Listen to a band called Leatherhead. They recorded a live album in the old basement at Old System at night, and it's coming out on my label in a couple of months. Just go to South London, go to like literally any venue.
Yeah, I think like you were talking about a lot of like live music as that, yeah, like you said, the Ivy House, Fox and Firkin, Matchstick Pie House, all amazing places. But I think also for like the club scene, yeah, we've got some like really amazing spaces for like that kind of community as well. Like Corsica and Four Quarters and
Corsica's new space in Peckham.
Yeah, Corsica's new space in Peckham, the carpet shop. Like, there's got a lot of like amazing places like that as well for DJs, which is really, really amazing. So like, a lot of like people come from all over the city to come play in South because like we have like such like well recognised and established places. So great.
I mean, why would you ever want to leave, right?
We're disappointed that you dragged us north of the river today.
Every time I get back to South London, it feels like this weight has been lifted. I get back and I'm like, oh, wow.
I can relax again. Well, look, thank you both for coming in. I think the work that you do is amazing, inspiring, and I know you talk about it being a fortuitous moment in time, but also without you having the confidence and the passion to take the risk, it wouldn't have happened. So thank you for doing what you do, and I'm looking forward to what's next to come. This is the midnight.
Thanks, hopefully we'll see you down in Lush and at a gig sometime maybe.
100%, I've got no excuses.
Lenny, Sophie and Lottie, who sadly couldn't be with us for the recording, you are nothing short of a revelation. If you don't know something, learn it. If you're passionate about something, go and stand up for it. Don't wait for someone else. Be the change you want to see. Be a little bit more like Sister Midnight. As always, there are links in the description to the recommendations made. Catch you next time, people.